Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday and Sunday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon. I'm Louis Sines, your host for Perspectives, and joining us today are Dr. Laura O'Dell, Dr. Luis Carcoba, and Joe Pipkin, and they're here to talk about some special research that they're doing in the psychology department. And we're going to talk a little bit about something that's very close to home also, and that's diabetes, because we have a huge number, as you all are aware, of diabetics here in El Paso. Diabetics who don't take care of themselves properly, myself included sometimes. And I lost a sister to diabetes last month, so that's very important. But anyway, we'd like to take the time to thank our guests for being here with us today. Thank you very much.
Glad to be here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, let's start, first of all, with Dr. Laura O'Dell. And may I call you Laura?
Sure.
Okay. Laura, tell me a little bit about the research that you're doing in psychology, because, and I mentioned, I asked you before the program started if it was okay to say drug addiction, because some people now are saying that they don't like the term drug because sometimes that's associated with perhaps the culture of the 60s and what was going on in the 60s. And they don't like there's a difference between addiction and tolerance and dependence. And so we can talk a little bit about that. But first of all, tell us a little bit about your research. You are the PI, the principal investigator in this program, this research project. If you would like to share with us kind of like the basis of it.
Sure. So first of all, I'm very sorry to hear about your sister, and I'm glad to be here to talk to you about addiction and how it affects so many people in our border community and throughout our country. So I'm a neuroscientist, and so our lab is very interested in understanding how the brain modulates motivated behavior. And so the questions that we ask are about the control that happens in the brain. So we do pharmacology type of research, and the end goal is to develop pharmacotherapies. And so key to that is a better understanding of what those substrates are in the brain. And so the way we like to think about our program, our research program, is studying vulnerable populations to tobacco use. And so if you look at a clinical setting, there's certain groups of people that are more susceptible to using tobacco. They're more, they have a harder time quitting when they begin using tobacco. And so in a laboratory setting, we're modeling those vulnerable populations. And the three that we're focused on currently are adolescents. And so young people initiate smoking at higher rates. We're also studying females. And so there's very important and robust sex differences when you look at tobacco use and quitting rates and things like that amongst females. And then the project that we're also working on and funded from the American Diabetes Association is looking at addiction to nicotine in diabetic models. And we're also learning that diabetic subjects have a harder time quitting smoking and seem to experience greater rewarding effects of nicotine.
And we'll talk a little bit more about that in just a minute. But as I mentioned before, with us, we have the pleasure of being joined by Professor Dr. Luis Carcoba. And Dr. Carcoba is not just a PhD, but also an MD. And you have studied some very unique situations when you were in Mexico. You want to share those with us, Doctor?
Right. It's very interesting for me because it's the reason I'm here at UTEP now. When I was in Mexico, I used to work with a population who they were using drugs. At that time, the main drug, okay, there were a lot of drugs, cocaine, but most of our patients were heroin addicts. Was a huge population of heroin addicts. One of the problems with patients using heroin is the percentage of relapse. It's very few amount or percentage of people using drugs, opiates, that they can say, okay, I'm cured. And most of them, they have relapse. And two of the main problems I saw over there, it was because they start relapsing using drugs again, or because they couldn't sleep, and the only way to sleep is using more drug again, start using drug again, or because they have pain. once they start using drugs, in this case heroin, they have a state where they have a lot of pain. So again, they start using drugs to alleviate the pain. So those were the main problems I saw. So I knew a professor here at UTEP. I came, I talked with him. He was doing studies in Dr. Rafael Cabeza in sleep. So at some point he invited me, okay, why you don't come here and let's do some research, experiments. And then later he said, okay, why don't you start doing a degree here? To make a long story short, I finished doing my PhD here in biology and working with Dr. Cabeza and trying to answer those kind of problems, pain problems, sleep problems. And then later I found Dr. Odell, and she's doing a very, very nice research, and she has findings. I mean, she has something, not just questions, she has answers in nicotine. So I'm thinking, okay, maybe later I can apply those findings from nicotine to extrapolate to heroin, to opiates. So that is the point that my actual situation right now.
Luis, and with all due respect, I hope you don't mind me calling you Luis. The fact that, as you mentioned, heroin and opiates, a lot of diabetics, and I mentioned that there are a lot of diabetics here in El Paso, and in fact, diabetes is just all over the United States. It's just it's horrible, but a lot of diabetics suffer from neuropathy. And because of the neuropathy, they'll get painkillers, and a lot of those painkillers are opiates. And so tell me a little bit about what the problems are, maybe there or aren't there, because sometimes people will say, well, you know what, you're using a painkiller for your diabetes or for whatever chronic pain you may have, but that's the same thing as using heroin or another type of opiate. And these are people who need it medically.
Well, there's a lot of, and this is one question, but this is a very complex question. First, let me talk to you a little about heroin. Heroin is a derivative, it's kind of synthetic. You have morphine, is the natural drug. And then, it's interesting because in one century ago, somebody put an acetyl group, modify a little the molecule of morphine, and they have heroin. Heroin is two or three times more potent than morphine. But okay, going back to the question, if it's, what happened with people that use opiates to alleviate pain, that this pain is coming from long-term diabetes, in the past, the idea was, okay, if you have diabetes and you have pain and you're taking opiates, that's going to be a problem for your diabetes, because once you're taking opiates, you can make change habits. Maybe you are under the effect of the drug and you're missing one meal, and that is your diabetes that's important, and you will have a dysregulation in your pattern of levels of sugar. So that was the idea. Now we know, and this is important because we know in an anecdotal form, we had to do research in this elements that we know now, or we have some evidence. We know that morphine, or any kind of morphine, legal or illegal, opiates, let's talk about opiates, pills for pain, they increase the levels of sugar in people. So if you're diabetic, it's not a good idea to take opiates, because the levels of glucose in your blood, they're increasing. But also we know that people with diabetes or the high levels of glucose in blood, they reduce or increase, let's see, they increase the threshold for pain. In other words, they feel less pain. So it's a very special situation. You're taking pills to combat pain. The fact that you have high levels of glucose is going to help you in the sense of the pain, so you feel less pain. But it's not helping you into your diabetes. So I think that is the challenge right now. To how to equilibrate that, how to find a better use so we can use the drugs in a way that we can control pain without making worse the diabetes. Diabetes is another different world.
And one of the things that can happen sometimes is if you're not giving someone pain relief, that stresses that person out, so the blood sugar levels go up also with the stress.
Mm-hmm. And the stress, you point something, another factor, stress. The stress also is going to modify the threshold for pain. So you may feel some more pain. At this point, connecting again with Dr. Odell's work, is now we know that it's gender difference. It's not the same, the pain in males than in females. And we go back to the original research with nicotine. If we can understand what happened in nicotine, we can later try to apply this to opiates.
Joe, let's talk a little bit about some of the research and some of the work that that you're doing and your graduate students. So a lot of hands-on stuff as well for you. And tell us about a little bit your research and what you've learned from what you've studied.
So my research interests revolve around studying the neurobiological and neurochemical mechanisms of drug-seeking behavior and relapse. And here at UTEP, focusing on diabetes and tobacco abuse. And essentially, we ask various questions of interest within a controlled setting that we believe are the basis for the behavioral and biological profiles that facilitate the enhanced rewarding effects of nicotine within diabetic subjects. So we use various behavioral paradigms as well as various biological techniques to assess these various questions of interest that we believe revolve around this vulnerability to diabetic subjects. So for the last 2 years, I've been, this has been my, for my dissertation, working under Dr. Odell and Dr. Karkova.
Laura, one of the things that you mentioned earlier, getting back to not the opiates, but the nicotine, the fact that you said that, and we were talking about one of my colleagues who quit cold turkey and after smoking for years and years and years. But you said that you have found out through your research that it's easier for men to do that.
Right. And we're not, our research is more focused on why it's harder for women than why it's easier for men.
Okay.
I'll be honest. So when we study in a laboratory setting, what we learn is that when you remove nicotine from a physiological organism, the removal of nicotine after chronic exposure to nicotine induces a stress response, very much like scaring the animal or tail pinching it or doing something that would be stressful. Just removing nicotine launches a stress response. And what we're learning is that that stress response is much stronger in a female than it is in a male. And so what that suggests is that there's this other component to quitting that's unique for females. And so as we treat nicotine, most of tobacco use is currently treated with nicotine itself. So you give somebody a patch to curb the craving so that they don't relapse. Our thought is that that may not be enough for a female. You may have to certainly use the nicotine replacement therapies, but what about using them in combination with anxiolytics or other things that can curb the stress that happens as a result of removing nicotine from the body?
Now, is this hormonal related in any way?
Ah, that's a beautiful question. And so I'm going to give Joe Pipkin credit. He's doing a very nice study right now where if you remove ovaries, ovarian hormones, you can develop a profile in a female that looks just like a male. So at least for now, it looks like it's very strongly ovarian hormone mediated. And so the reason we believe that's the case is if you look at the anatomy, estrogen is anatomically positioned in the brain to promote the effects of nicotine. So females are sort of biologically built to have a different response to nicotine than males. And this is going to be driven by the ovaries where estrogen is released.
So, Joe, in your research, and I'm not sure if you even touched on this, but I know that for some women, when they're going through menopause and when they're going through you know, hormone, whether it be synthetic hormones or natural hormones, is something that's very stressful for them. And, you know, I've heard women say, I feel like I'm climbing the walls. I feel horrible. And, you know, I can't even explain. It must feel horrible. So did you do any of that, any of those studies with menopausal women and the fact that was it different or different pre or after? And what about men as far as like low testosterone or anything like that? Or does that not affect it at all with that hormone?
We have not begun to look at men or rats per se. Certainly, we would be very interested in looking at the contribution of testicular hormones. There's a lot of questions there. But because the females are the vulnerable population, our work has sort of focused on the females. But certainly, there are likely several male hormones that contribute to tobacco use in males. And probably the neatest thing that we're learning is that there's also lifespan issues. And so Joe's work has focused on ovarian hormones in a female that might receive a hysterectomy if we equate ages. The questions that you're asking are, what does the smoking profile look like as a female develops? And that's a question that we're just beginning to think about. Our work has focused on youth. Now Joe is looking at the critical role of ovarian hormones in which you might consider an adult female. But recently I gave a talk at a women's center at Texas A&M University, and they asked me that exact question. What about senescence and aging females? And if I'm honest, we have not begun to look at that, but you can look at senescence in a lab setting also.
What about – you mentioned the patch earlier. So the latest craze is, as you all are aware of, e-cigarettes.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad we can talk about that.
So do those help, or is that just kind of encouraging someone like Dr. Luis said also, a synthetic drug almost?
Sure. Maybe Karkova should answer this, but I'll give you my impression is that, you know, whenever you have a new product that's not FDA approved, the obvious question is whether or not it's safe. The e-cigarettes are being put out there as a nicotine replacement therapy, which is fine. If you can replace the nicotine in your body, you're going to curb the craving and not use a cigarette, a tobacco cigarette, which has 5,000 chemicals in it. Fine. However, there's a lot of additives and there's a lot of things that are put in the e-cigarettes. Odorants. So a lot of them are vanilla or anise or other flavorings. And there are things that you have to add to the nicotine to make it volatile. Nicotine is an oil in its free base form. And so we really need to study and ask questions. I mentioned to you I was in a mall and somebody offered me an e-cigarette at a kiosk to sell me one. And the young man said, you know, would you like one? I said, no, thank you. I'm not a smoker. He said, well, they're healthy. And that's my concern right now is how they're being marketed as a healthy alternative, and they're not. They're not. One of the things that we study in our lab is the long-term effects of nicotine exposure. And one of the probably the scariest things that we learn is that if you expose an adolescent to nicotine, they're more likely to take it as an adult. And so when I see these young kids smoking e-cigarettes, we are setting them up for a lifetime of propensity to smoke. And that's a risk. That's a risk.
Luis, sometimes some people have said that quitting smoking is harder than quitting heroin or other hard drugs.
Well, in general, the addiction is a multifactorial problem. We're focusing in the drug with effects on the drug in the brain. But also the environment is another factor we have to take in account. Also the question, why in a family with four brothers, to say something, the same father, the same environment, one is using drug and the other is not? The relationship between different factors is hard to anticipate. For some people, yes, they say it's easier to quit nicotine. Some others say no, heroin, opiate. But I think we don't have really an answer. It depends a lot on the person.
Laura mentioned the fact that, you know, e-cigarettes are becoming trendy. Mm-hmm. And they are sold online, and you see them everywhere just about now. So one of the questions that I have is not that it's becoming trendy, but we're starting to see PSAs, public service announcements, about drugs. And they say something like, it used to be that you were worried about your child going down the street and seeing the local drug dealer and buying something. But now all they have to do is go to your medicine cabinet. So the fact that a lot of people are abusing or misusing prescription drugs, that in a way kind of penalizes people who actually need the medications.
Well, yes, that's another situation. Okay, three things here, and I go back a little to
Laura's
question, because I think she mentioned two things that are very, very important. First, there is not enough evidence about if it's safe or not, so we cannot say if it's safe or not. For the people in the audience, we don't know. And the second, I think probably more important, you go and you talk with young people about this, they have the impression in their mind, they know it's safe, and this is a very high risk factor. You want to trying to do some prevention, the first thing you have to change is the mind. That is not safe, because it's like a marijuana. You can ask for a lot of young people about marijuana. No, it's safe. It's safe. And they want to use it because in their mind it's safe, when we know that is not true. And it's the same situation with this kind of product. So the perception that we have on those drugs. And in regards to the other question, yes, it's a big risk having drugs in your cabinet and the kids over there. But let me extrapolate a little the situation. There's a lot of different groups of people abusing drugs. If we talk about pills, opiates, legal pills, the big group abusing these pills are doctors or health-related personnel, nurses, because they have access to that. And how we can handle that. They need access to those drugs to provide treatment for other people. So it's kind of the same situation. Yes, people they need drugs. They have in their house, in the cabinet. I think the answer is more campaigns directed to the parents or the adults so they can see the risk and they can act in consequence. Okay, I don't need this anymore, so let me get rid of this. But yes, again, it's not a single answer.
Laura, as far as the addiction goes, is there a difference between addiction and tolerance? And I'm talking about perhaps maybe somebody who suffers from chronic pain or who has cancer or some other disease with a lot of pain. And so they've been taking the medication for so long that after a while, the body may get used to it.
Yeah. Great question. So I think it's important to differentiate that because certainly if you're somebody that's in chronic pain and needs to use opiates to manage your pain, that's a very different scenario than somebody that's using drugs recreationally. So I think that's an important distinction to make. We have a diagnostic and statistical manual that psychologists use to diagnose somebody with addiction and dependence. One of those criteria is tolerance, and that's the idea that the same amount of medication is no longer effective, so you've got to take more and more and more of the substance. But that's only one characteristic of several definitions. And the way I'd like to simplify it for you is that if you're dependent or abusing a drug, there's a lack of social and occupational functioning. That means that you can't work, you can't maintain friendships, and it's affecting your home life. And that's the best litmus test to give you in a quick description. And that's different for somebody that's managing pain. It can change to that. But I think that distinction is very important to make.
So someone who is going to work and going about their everyday things, whether they're in pain or not, that's the difference between tolerance and addiction in a sort of answer.
Sure. So we think of tolerance physiologically, which is your body needing more, and that's dependence. What you're describing in terms of abuse is when you're stealing, lying, cheating, destroying your life to get the drug. And so the way that I've heard it defined is dependence with a capital D versus dependence with a little d. You can become dependent. Most of us are on coffee. Okay? But we're not lying, stealing, killing to get coffee. Well, maybe we are. But there's a big difference there between dependence with a capital D, which then is your seeking drugs is affecting your social and occupational functioning.
As far as the nicotine goes, are you limited? Is the study limited to cigarettes alone, or are you talking about all tobacco?
So we are studying the active ingredient in tobacco, which is nicotine. But there's a lot of growing research that there's a lot of very other interesting compounds. There's 5,000 or more compounds in tobacco. And one of them that's come out as being very important is monoamine oxidase inhibitors, which are essentially antidepressants. And that's fascinating because the idea there is people talk about a self-medication hypothesis with tobacco where you're using the tobacco to help yourself with a medical problem. And so I would be naive to say that nicotine is the only ingredient that's probably helping the dependence trajectory. There are a lot of other things in the cigarette, but nicotine is the one that we believe is the driving the addiction.
I'm not a smoker or a drinker.
Good.
From when you see people who are nervous in oh my gosh, I showed this week to my class 12 Angry Men, a classic film with Henry Fonda. But my gosh, they must have gone through like 8 cartons of cigarettes,
yeah,
you know,
in that one
movie.
Yeah.
But the question is, I guess, is, doctor, do people feel a sense of relief for, and I'm not sure because, like I said, I'm not a smoker or a drinker, because you see people when they get nervous, they light up a
mm-hmm.
cigarette
yeah.
or whatever, especially in the movies.
Yes. No, that was the point that Laura was mentioning. Yes, it's kind of self-medication. This is
a tool.
A tool, exactly. Mm-hmm. They use nicotine because it's relaxing for them. We know that nicotine, depending on the doses, can be relaxing or can be excitatory for other functions in your body. But most of the people do that. If you ask them why they're smoking, because they feel better. And again, it's another question. It's the problem with the drugs. Most of the people start using drugs because they feel some advantage. If not, they won't start using it.
Yeah.
And that happened a lot with tobacco, nicotine. They feel something changed, good change in for them at that moment, and they start using it. And then it become an addiction habit. Mm-hmm. But yes, they use it for that reason.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but we still have a lot of stuff to talk about, so we're going to have to bring you all back and talk a little bit about how your research is going. But we've been visiting with Dr. Laura Odell, Dr. Luis Carcoba, and Joe Pipkin, and they've been doing a study on nicotine and also nicotine basically on adolescents, females, and also males and diabetics, correct? And if people want to know additional information about your study, should they just go to the psychology webpage or what they
sure.
need to do?
We have links through the psychology webpage.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sainz.